Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from the Durham Museum on Noon Forum. We'll hear a presentation by three Omaha authors, each of whose novels take place in Omaha within a 20-year period of the early 20th century. The 1998 Trans-Mississippi and International Exposition, Omaha from 1900 to 1905, and the 1919 Race Riots, Timothy Shaffert, author of The Swan Gondola, Andrew Hilleman, author of World Chase Me Down, and Theodore Wheeler, author of Kings of Broken Things. The title of their presentation is Objects of Inspiration, Creating Historical Fiction Based in Fact. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 26, 2017, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Carrie Meyer, Director of Curatorial and Education Services at the Durham Museum.
Tonight we'll explore what it takes to write historical fiction. All three authors this evening used the Durham Museum's collection as a resource for writing their most recent books. Each is set in Omaha, but focus on very different aspects of our city's history. Our presentation this evening is a little different than normal. We'll begin with each author providing you a small taste of his book through a 10-minute reading. Following the introductions and readings, there will be a short moderated question time, followed by time for you to ask your own questions of the authors. We will be going in chronological order this evening. So our first reading is from The Swan Gondola by Timothy Shaffert, set during the 1898 Trans-Mississippi and International Exposition here in Omaha. This novel recreates the few months that Nebraska served as an international capital. Complete with lavish temporary palaces and a cast of cynical hucksters, pickpockets, and performers who earn their living on the Midway. Through the historical details about the fair's construction, delight, it's the love story of a certain ventriloquist named Ferret Skerritt and an actress named Cecily that captivates, most especially when a rival to Ferret threatens to separate the two. But be prepared for a romantic finish and some unexpected twists in the plot that prove magic is possible, even for magicians. Timothy Shaffert is the author of five novels, most recently The Swan Gondola. His work has been widely acclaimed and featured or reviewed in many local and national publications and broadcasts. He is a Susan J. Rozowski Associate Professor of English at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Please welcome Mr. Timothy Shaffert.
Thank you so much, Carrie, and thank you all so much for being here tonight. When I was trying to figure out what to read, I thought, well, I should read something that depicts the exposition. And then I thought, well, maybe I should read something that's set over yonder there at the Burlington Station. But then I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the actual items that I had an opportunity to look at and to think about when I was working on the novel, and how difficult it is, and I think this will come up in the conversation, of depicting the day-to-day of the characters' lives and just the items that they collect and their personal experiences as opposed to the broader portrait. And so I'm going to read something from late in the book, actually, so there's some spoilers, I guess, but... So at this point, Cecily, who's an actress and who was at the exposition, has settled in with Wakefield, who is one of the city's wealthy businessmen in town. And so, and part of what has motivated this is because she has a little girl named Doxy. But this meant her having to abandon Ferret, who's the narrator of the book. So at this point, he's meeting her covertly, and so the scene that's depicted reflects some of those corners of the city that aren't necessarily depicted in the historical materials that as a historical novelist, when you're trying to put together those things that have not been described, is one of the great challenges, I think. So there's been a meeting arranged between Cecily and Ferret at a Chinese doctor on Douglas Street. It actually was a Chinese doctor or a man who claimed to be a Chinese doctor named Dr. G. Loy in Omaha at the time. We didn't talk about the summer just passed. We didn't talk at all. She wouldn't let me speak. She said when she saw me. Cecily had expected me and took my hand the moment she walked in the door. She led me down a hall through a dimly lit rabbit warren of little rooms and sleeping berths. Shh. I've grown to hate hellos even more than I hate goodbyes, she said as we ducked through a curtain. She shook my hand, gentlemanly. It's a pleasure to meet you, mister, ma'am, miss, a pleasure. The pleasure is all mine, to be sure. She curtsied, she bowed, she tisked and tut-tutted, and she handed me her fur stole and her scarf and her hat, flinging them all into my arms with the lazy wrists of a wealthy matron. She took off a winter glove lined with white rabbit, and she held her bared hand to my lips when I went to speak again. Shh, she said. The doctor needs absolute silence. Dr. G. Loy had come in, and he placed a sheet across a black table inlaid with pearl. When you're allowed to speak again, Cecily told me, remind me to buy a new chameleon from the doctor. Pinned to the breast of her dress was a little chain with a ring at the end of it, a leash. The fashionable ladies wear the chameleons as jewelry, she said. It's sweet to have a little heart thumping against mine when I'm buried in cadavers. She sneered at the head of the muskrat propped up on the fur stole in my arms. I'm cold all the time, so he keeps buying me furs. She unpinned the chain and stuck it into the lapel of my coat. She leaned in to whisper. The chameleons keep getting away from me, but if I don't rescue them from the doctor, I don't know what's to become of them. Any chameleon in Dr. G. Loy's apothecary would likely end up dried or powdered. The doctor's methods of treatment crawled with dead bugs and reptiles. In the apothecary jars on the shelves of the office that fronted the street were the roasted larvae of grasshoppers for headaches and the dusty husks of silkworm moths for fainting fits and dead scorpions for rheumatism. There were little red-spotted lizards dried to a crisp and rattles without their snakes. I suspected it was all for show, all the labels facing out, promising cures you wouldn't find anywhere else. It seemed nothing but hocus-pocus, just like everything else did those days. But Cecily, to my great relief, seemed better somehow, much, much better. She had color in her cheeks, life in her eyes. When she turned her back to me, lifting a few stray tendrils of hair up from her neck, asking me to undo the buttons of her collar, of the back of her dress, I was with her again on the night we first met backstage at the Empress Theater. I placed the first stole and the hat in a chair, and I brought my fingers to the buttons, and I worked slowly, so slowly, and she let me. She stretched her neck forward. She touched her fingertips to mine. Once I'd opened her collar, I leaned forward to kiss her skin, and she reached back to run her fingers across my cheek. I was willing to trust anything Dr. G. Loy prescribed, even the vial of tiger's blood and the tincture of dragon's tooth. Cecily stripped to a suit of underthings, every bit as fancy as the dress itself, with all its ribbons and ruffles of lace. The doctor held a candle to Cecily's tongue to study the pink of it. He put his fingers to her wrist and whistled a tune to the rhythm of the beats of her pulse. I helped Cecily onto the table, and she lay back. She held quills of bamboo. A girl with a braid assisted the doctor. She held the quills of bamboo, sorry. He heated the skin of Cecily's arms and shoulders of her neck by pressing against it an enamel pot of burning mugwort. Don't I make a pretty porcupine? Cecily told me as the doctor gently riddled her skin with the quills. Shh, I said. She said, yes, shh. This is the only place I can sleep anymore. And she closed her eyes and drifted off. I became mesmerized by the rise and fall of her chest as she breathed and as her breathing slowed more and more. Her breaths shivered the little silk roses at the knot of a ribbon between her breasts. In the 20 minutes that the doctor worked, I considered what I'd say when she woke. I knew I must be careful. If I said what I wanted to say, leave with me now, she might never return. I would have to let her let me know what to say next and when. The doctor finished, removed the quills, and said, wake her, as he left the room. I stood next to the table. How could her breaths fall so far apart? She seemed to be barely breathing at all. I leaned over to kiss her lips, and as I kissed her, she kissed me too, and she held her hand to the back of my head. I helped her from the table, and when I tried to speak again, she shushed me once more. "We'll talk tomorrow," she said. I helped her with her dress and her fur and her hat and her gloves. When we weren't looking, the doctor had brought a little paper box containing a new chameleon. "Help me think of a name for him," she said, and she slipped past the curtain and down the hall and out the back way. Cecily visited Dr. G. Loy and me every day after that, as Wakefield spent his afternoons attending to the fair in its final few weeks in an endless parade of backslapping and celebratory lunches for a job well done. Cecily slipped from his side and into the coach, and she stole into town for our secret afternoons. She claimed to Wakefield and to her driver to be putting together her winter wardrobe and needed to devote hours to the dress department of Brandeis. At the store, she had tea as the shop girls modeled gowns, and she stood for fittings, allowing herself to be spotted by the gossips and scandalmongers. She then snuck away to weave through the store, around the shelves and mannequins, and out the back. She moved then in her furs of blue fox and chinchilla and electric seal, in her silks and diamonds, a veil across her face, from back alley to back alley, across the dirty broken bricks, through inky puddles, past the skittering of rats and the grumbling of bums, until she came to the back door of Dr. G. Loy's. We would spend an hour together, then she would leave alone to retrace her steps. As she hurried through Brandeis's again, Pearl, the shop girl, would hand her paper bags full of boxes, of novelty shirtwaists, of boots, of a pigeon wing to clip to her hair with a diamond-studded clasp. Wakefield would tease her at breakfast about her shopping, amused by her girlish pleasure in fashion and jewelry. They would spend their mornings in the conservatory, the autumn sun hot through the glass overhead. Wakefield would eat a steak delivered directly from one of the slaughterhouses he owned in South Omaha, and he would feign shock and disgust over the Brandeis bill open at his side. He read aloud the list of clothing and gifts, clucking his tongue. More often than not, Cecily would not have even opened the boxes yet, and she would only just learn of their contents from Wakefield's recitations. She was always caught up, she told me, in thoughts of our afternoons together. Cecily would butter her blueberry muffin with butterine, also from the slaughterhouse, made from cattle fat and oil. And she'd drink Hawaiian coffee, sitting in a kimono of blue satin, relaxed, happy, distracted. I imagine that Wakefield loved playing the part of a husband who indulged his spoiled wife too much. I could picture him boasting to other men, "My darling canary gilding her cage." Meanwhile, behind his back, Ferret, the weasel, robbed the very rich groom of his very pretty bride. Cecily and I met every day of those few weeks in October. She wouldn't allow me to walk her through the alleys, afraid we'd get caught together lurking about. So every day I waited in a room lit only with the low flame of a linseed oil lamp hanging from the ceiling by a chain. This was not the private room where Cecily took the acupuncture, but a room full of people sleeping. Each wall was lined with berths, like in a train car, three beds high. Some patients snored behind curtains, others lay with the curtains open, the pipes falling from their hands as they dropped into sleep. The room had a haze of vapor that had no way out, as there were no windows, and only the one door always kept shut. "And if we get caught, it's over," she said. "He would never let me out again." From Cecily's little black hat hung a lace veil tatted to resemble a cobweb. Cecily pulled out the hat pin at the top of the veil, the pin's head spider-shaped, the spider's abdomen a teardrop pearl. I took off my boots, my coat, my collar, my cuffs. Dr. G. Loy stepped in with a tray, and on the tray, a long bamboo pipe and an opium lamp. We never smoked the stuff, but Cecily liked to inhale the medicinal haze puffed up by all the other smokers in the den. "Not opium," the doctor explained to a new patient on the other side of the room. He set down the tray and tapped his finger against the pipe's bowl. "Swallow's nests, crushed lizard bones, pipe tobacco, maybe just a little bit opium." The pipe's red enamel was patterned with bats. "Bats bring happiness," the doctor said. "What do the characters mean?" the patient asked, running his fingers along the calligraphy that lined the top of the bowl. "Opium better than money," he said. He tapped again at the pipe's bowl, but no opium here. None, just a little. So little it is almost none at all. A little opium to ease you away from it. This room was where addicts gathered to kick the habit. When you start to see your dreams, Dr. G. Loy told his patient, lie back and look. Cecily whispered to me, this medicine ain't for the weak, she said. She winked at me and tugged on my chin. We both lay back on the bed together, our heads on the same pillow. I put my hand on her hand. Her skin was like ice. Leave him, I whispered. Get Doxy and run away with me. After a moment, Cecily said, I will. And I could have wept at the sound of it. I will, as precious as a wedding vow. Thank you.
Thank you, Tim. Our second reading this evening is from World Chase Me Down by Andrew Hilleman. A kidnapper with a social justice mission, Pat Crow was once the most wanted man in America. World Chase Me Down resurrects him, telling the electrifying story of the first great crime of the last century, how in 1900, the out-of-work former butcher kidnapped the teenage son of Omaha's wealthiest meatpacking tycoon for a ransom of $25,000 in gold, and then burgled, safe-cracked, and bond-jumped his way across the country and beyond, inciting a manhunt that was dubbed the Thrill of the Nation and a showdown in the court of public opinion between the haves and have-nots, all the while plotting a return to the woman he never stopped loving. Andrew Hilleman was born and raised in Omaha, Nebraska. He earned his BA and MA in English at Creighton University and his MFA in fiction from Northern Michigan University. He's taught courses in composition, technical writing, and creative writing, and also worked as a fiction editor for the editorial department based in Tucson, Arizona. His fiction has appeared in Fiddlehead Magazine and was a finalist for Glimmer Train's Short Fiction Award. His debut novel, World Chase Me Down, was published in January 2017 and centers on the first successful ransom for a kidnapping in the history of the United States. Please welcome Mr. Andrew Hilleman.
Thank you, Carrie, and thank you, everyone, for coming. I chose two small parts instead of one to read tonight, because what I really wanted to do was, since because of this event, is to paint a picture of what Omaha looked like at the turn of the 20th century. So the first segment I'm going to read from is a little part that describes the stockyards, and the second part takes place at the Burlington train station just across the street from here, both right around, one was in 1899 and the other was in 1905. So I will begin with the section that takes place in the stockyards of South Omaha. I first met Billy almost 2 years earlier. It was the last summer of the old century, 1899. The streets bright with rain from the previous night's thunderstorm. All of Omaha sequined by sunlight on raindrops, clinging to windows and store signs. Yellow trolleys and dinging streetcars zipped along their routes, carrying full loads of people to work. Shop doors had opened for business. Photography suppliers, confectionaries, a 10-story department store where a person could buy anything from a portable sewing machine to a tub of jelly. A clothier balanced a tower of hats for sale on his head. A woman in a cocktail dress entered a syphilis clinic. Last night's thunderbolts, apparently not the only thing that shook the bedposts. A mangy mutt, missing whole chunks of fur, lapped up gutter water streaming down from a roof pitch. Youngsters in wash suits and soap-lock haircuts played stickball with broom handles in the street, using manhole covers as bases between the bouts of passing traffic before the sun was full out and the whole city purple with heat. Another advertisement for Menon's toilet powder, this one pasted on the side of a bulletin wagon, came to a halt at a sidewalk flag stop. Drying linens garlanded fire escapes. Wash lines were hung between tenement windows. Neighborhood laundry, the flags of the alleys. My days were spent hauling hogs on my back with a meat hook over my shoulder from the slaughterhouse to the rail cars. They were cut in half lengthwise with the head still attached and weighed upwards of 80 pounds. My spine felt as weak as shoestring most days by noon time. Dry manure dust clouded the air, perpetual as a London morning fog. Some days I had a shovel in my hand for so long that when I finally got to setting it down at quitting time, it felt like I'd lost a third limb. During my long work days, I hardly spoke a word to anyone. Many took me for a mute or an invalid. My facial expression always suggested that of a man looking for paradise over the next bend. One afternoon in the stockyards, after lunching on ham and white bread from a tin cookie box, a scuffle broke out in the gravel yard in front of the loading docks. I was sitting on the ground against a pig pen wall and starting my pipe when I first heard the commotion. Four big bohemians circled around a fellow about my age. He was bleeding from his block-shaped head and dancing around with his fist raised, poised like a rattler for the next attack. If it weren't for the foolish attempt at a beard growing in his cheeks, I might have thought him to be 12 or 13 years old. The four men around him kicked up dust in the air, hooting and hollering. At first I didn't move, nor did any of the men seated alongside me in a row against the pig pen wall as they finished their lunches. One of the bohemians wielded a jackknife. Another held a chunk of broken pavement as big as a brick and launched at the back of the young man's head, knocking him flat on his stomach. The four crushers threw up their hands in excitement and hopped around shouting as if celebrating a last-second sporting victory in a gymnasium. The young boy groaned on the ground, still conscious, but barely so. His hair full of blood, he tried to stand up but couldn't lift his own body. The 30-odd men who had been watching the fight were as indifferent about witnessing the beating as if they were reading about it in newsprint the day after. I had seen enough. And I'll stop there with that. A pretty bloody brawl ensues after that, if you're interested. So, but that's just a little snippet of the portrait of what I could conjure from a lot of it, from looking at pictures of what the stockyards looked like. And the second section I'm going to read very quickly took place after Pat Crow, the kidnapper, was, he had a, there was a five-year-long manhunt for him after he got away with the kidnapping, and he was finally brought back to Omaha in 1905, destitute and homeless, living on the street, and he had quite the hero's welcome, much to his surprise, in 1905 when his train rolled into the Burlington Depot. So this is where it begins. Sun flash of dawn, red and cold, and Omaha appeared on the horizon. Our chuffing train slowing over the 10th Street Viaduct as it pulled into the Burlington Depot. Despite the zero weather, the platform filled with triple rows of excited people awaiting my arrival. I peered out my window as the train jolted to a stop, a handprint from long ago smeared on the glass. Brake steam hissed, the locomotive a giant kettle on wheels. People everywhere in their sullen raiment, men in tattered farm coats patched with sacking, women in muted ducking and smoke-stained furs and silly hats full of feathers. Here and there a child on his father's shoulders to get a better view. Tobacco smoke and frozen breath rolled in little clouds over the heads. Pockets of the crowd murmured in scraps of English pieced together from their quilted vocabulary. Pat Crow was on that train. A man in a brimless hat exclaimed that their hero was coming home. I didn't know what to make of that. I surely did not. The crowd hooted and hollered. Farther down, a woman with a dirty face and a jacket patched in poverty, and nearly all alone in the world because of it, prayed with a rag. Or so it appeared from my vantage. She twisted her hanky in her hands as if it were a rosary. Among the crowd were nearly 40 uniformed police officers and a hive of newspaper reporters in fedoras with press cards in their hat bands, their paper tablets and short pencils at the ready. Some of the onlookers arrived still in their heavy wool sleeping clothes. Even a couple in bathrobes and slippers. Every rank of life anxious to glimpse what the morning headlines of the newspapers the country over had been declaring for the past 4 days. Pat Crow captured. My train had been delayed nearly a full day due to blizzards in the western part of the state. Railroad lines were impassable until rotary snowplows with two locomotives coupled behind them wormed through the heaps of powder. In some parts of the track, snowdrifts were cut through 10 feet deep, nearly as tall as the locomotive itself. Finally, the steam engine rolled to a stop. Newspaper cameras raised up by cogwheels and balanced upon tripods were draped with cloth over their maple wood boxes. Shutters snapped, and flash pans burst magnesium powder into the air like gun smoke, hoping to capture the moment I exited the train. Under heavily armed guard, I stepped forward in a lockstep shuffle, chains connecting my manacles to my ankle bracelets. The crowd pushed forward to the edge of the platform and erupted in cheers as if welcoming home boys from the war. Hooray, they cried. Hooray for Pat Crow. Thank you.
Thanks, Andy. Our last reading this evening is from Kings of Broken Things by Theodore Wheeler. During the waning days of World War I, three lost souls find themselves adrift in Omaha at a time of unprecedented nationalism, xenophobia, and political corruption. Adolescent European refugee Carl Milstein's life is transformed after neighborhood boys discover his prodigious natural talent for baseball. Jake Strauss, a young man with a violent past and desperate for a second chance, is drawn into a criminal underworld. Evie Chambers, a kept woman, is trying to make ends meet and looking every which way to escape her cheerless existence. As wounded soldiers return from the front and black migrant workers move north in search of economic opportunity, the immigrant wards of Omaha become a tinderbox of racial resentment stoked by unscrupulous politicians. Punctuated by an unspeakable act of mob violence, the fates of Carl, Jake, and Evie will become inexorably entangled with the schemes of a ruthless political boss whose will to power knows no bounds. Theodore Wheeler is the author of the novel Kings of Broken Things and a collection of short stories titled Bad Faith. His fiction has appeared in numerous anthologies and magazines. He's won the Marianne Rousseau Award from the Key West Literary Seminar, and in the summer of 2014, was a fellow at the Akademie Schloss Solitude, from Stuttgart, Germany. A graduate of the MFA program at Creighton University, he lives in Omaha, where he covers a legal and politics beat as a reporter and teaches creative writing at the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Please welcome Mr. Theodore Wheeler.
Hi, everyone. Thanks a lot for coming out tonight. Probably as a lot of you may or may not know, in World War I, that era, there were these things called four-minute men, where basically they would go and give propaganda speeches on soapboxes that would last 4 minutes. Going off of that inspiration, I've kind of divided up a few readings that are roughly 4 minutes long. I'm not quite that precise, but I was going to read two of those for you this evening. This first one, which is about Will Brown. So the novel is kind of set around thematically the Omaha race riot of 1919 and the lynching of Will Brown. So I'll start reading with his section. Everyone had a theory about who he was. No one knew for sure. He's someone the boys wondered about a lot in the years after 1919, after what they did that September. Will Brown. What was he thinking when the cops handed him over? Could he hear what that mob promised to do to him? Consider that Will Brown lived in Gibson. It wasn't easy for a black man there, not far from Rourke Park and right next to Riverview Park. He was 40 years old, pockmarked with a small mustache. He came from Cairo, Illinois. Some said Will Brown got a girl pregnant and a judge in Cairo was going to order them married. That was how he ended up in Omaha, running out on that girl. Men like him moved around so much, it was hard to say what made them go from one place to the next. Most of them in Omaha worked in stockyards, a lot of them scabs who took the jobs of doughboys. A black man was guaranteed nearly $2 a day in the yards. with some money to spend, a place to live, life would have been good enough for Will Brown. But he was getting old that summer. He felt bad in his back, his legs and arms. His neck would have always been twisted. Some days it wasn't all that bad if he didn't get work, if he could rest on a park bench and look at a newspaper. Otherwise, it meant staying home. He and another black man lived under the same roof with a white woman that year. Their place on Cedar Street wouldn't have been much, in some backwater ward bisected by freight lines, a shack so close to the Missouri that Will Brown could sit on a tar paper roof with a bottle and watch the river swell in the late hours if he wanted to. He could have seen riverboats float downstream at night, electric lights shimmering on the water, heard cornet calls echoing off the cottonwoods on the Iowa side. There wasn't much legitimate fun a black man could have down in South Omaha besides going to a lunchroom for beans and coffee. Sitting on a roof and listening to a jazz band play a riverboat was a jubilation most nights. If he felt sick and sore, it would be. People on those boats wore white suits and dresses and bathed in electric light. They drank illegal booze and danced to hot music. Everybody else had to sit down in the muck to listen. If they lived down in the muck, they'd hear by and by, like Will Brown would have. So the second part I want to read follows Carl Muehlstein, who is one of the lead characters in the book. For the most part, the whole novel is narrated through a group of young boys who live in the immigrant wards in Omaha at the time. So these are kind of the main focus and the main perspective of the book. Consider Carl Muehlstein. In 1917, he was 11 years old, new to Omaha, fresh off the boat when he met the boys in the schoolyard. He was from Salzburg, he said, but had come from Galizien, over there, where the Eastern Front of the war was being fought. His father repaired musical instruments. His mother had been a famous actress and singer out in the far reaches of the empire his family fled from. But his mother was dead by then. She died back there. And maybe this was why his family had to run from Europe in such a hurry like they did. And of course, there was the war. Carl was an interesting kid. He had talents. His English came off as well as his German. He could run. He was bigger than most boys his age and knew a little violin when pressed to play. But these were inessential skills. That spring, Carl got to know the boys on Clandish, so he learned how important it was here to be good at baseball. Once the weather turned warm, the boys divvied into teams. They were the oldest in their school, 11, 12, 13, at the end of boyhood. Carl wasn't the last one picked that year, even though he didn't have a clue how to play. There were two others who were known to be horrible at baseball for reasons that couldn't be helped. One whose rickety legs were being straightened by iron braces, and another whose hair was kept shorn to eradicate the bugs that plagued him. So Carl grinned when the captains from one team grabbed his arm and pulled him to their side before it came down to the final pick. Alfred Brown and Jimmy Mack, boys from his class, were the two who picked him. It wasn't until then that they asked if he even played. "I never held a baseball before," Carl admitted. "You kidding? Can you throw?" It was no use lying. Once they fetched the ball and Carl sort of flipped its sidearm to Alfred, sort of rolled the ball in the schoolyard gravel, they saw all they needed to see. "You live with Mrs. Maria, yeah?" Alfred asked. "Sure he does," Jimmy said. "I seen him before. You got all sisters, don't you?" "Yeah." "That's fine. They're pretty." Carl didn't like to talk about his sisters. The elder pair teased him a lot and were too old to care about anyway. But Carl's other sister, Anna, was only a year older than him. He protected her. "Don't you think they're pretty, your sisters?" Alfred sucked on the pit of a cherry. He kept fruit in his pockets, stolen from the market, like lots of kids did. If Carl was going to make friends with any of the boys, he could do worse than Alfred Brown and Jimmy McHenry. Sure, Jimmy was measly-faced, Irish, and Carl had been warned against trusting the Irish. Then there was Alfred, who had wide hips and a big rump that ballooned his trousers and back. He never wore a belt because he didn't need one. Alfred didn't have baby fat on his cheeks either, a strange thing for a stout boy, like all his mash should erode to his feet. "You're turning conical is all," Jimmy sometimes teased, cinching his own narrow shoulders to mimic Alfred's form. "A walking, talking dunce cap. That's what you are." Neither Jimmy nor Alfred came from model families. This made Carl feel better about the boys, like he was one of them. They had questions for Carl now that he was on their team, what work his father did and why his sister Anna was pulled from school. How Carl lived in New York City for a year after he came over, saw the Statue of Liberty, and went to the polo grounds once, but only because he and his father took the wrong 9th Avenue L transfer and ended up in Harlem by mistake, and not necessarily to see Christy Mathewson and the Giants play. Even though he didn't know who the ace hurler Christy Mathewson was, the boys respected Carl once he told how he'd escaped from the war in Europe. He and his father and his sisters had run halfway across the continent to board an American ocean liner in Bremerhaven. There was fighting where he lived before that. "Is that why you haven't got a mom?" Jimmy asked. "Did she die in the war?" "Yeah," Carl admitted. "She was killed." He felt himself toughen saying that, staring past those boys into the street. He hadn't been able to say it before. It was his mother who Carl took after. She'd had a round face and big cheeks and strong shoulders like Carl did. He didn't really remember her. His sisters told him these things. That's how he knew anything, secondhand. He had to accept what his sisters said, how his mother was beautiful and cruel sometimes if she felt like it, and how she was killed in Austria-Hungary and northernmost Galicia among the Carpathian Mountains, by Tsarist Russian soldiers, by a Serb assassin, by a stray bullet. Carl knew nothing about that. His sisters wouldn't tell. He didn't want to know how it happened anyway, not as a boy. She was his mother. She'd smiled at him, tucked him into bed, then lifted him from his blankets in the morning and fed him sugary bits torn from a marzipan pastry. He remembered that, didn't he? That was all he had of her. Thank you.
Thank you, Ted. We'll now explore a little bit of the method and madness of writing historical fiction. I'll address questions to each of you, but feel free to chime in as you have an opportunity. This is a little bit of a conversation. So, Tim, I'll start with you. What would you say inspired you to write about Omaha, and specifically the Transmiss? What was it?
Well, when I started reading the material, like the various news clippings, and you know, I was thinking about it. I wanted to write about Victorian Omaha, and so I kept being led in my research to the exposition, and the more I read about the exposition, the more fascinated I was with some of the ironies and the effort versus the results, and the whole idea that that it was designed to promote Omaha in the way that Chicago's exposition promoted Chicago, and how it was meant to promote to the world that the city was a serious city, right? That it was that it contributed to the nation's politics and art and industry, and which of course was doing, but it also wanted to communicate to the nation that it wasn't this Wild West town, only to have people come to town and discover that it still had much of the Wild West about it. So so all of those paradoxes, I guess, seemed compelling to me, and the characters kind of emerged from that.
And then, Andy, as it goes from the Wild West, where Tim's is trying to not be the Wild West, Omaha proves that it has some more seamier sides. What about you? What was it so intriguing? How did you hear about the story of Pat Crow?
Oh, well, I found out about Pat Crow through accident. I was researching about Tom Dennison, who's a character in Ted's book, and as far as Omaha crime goes, he's about as famous as it gets in Omaha history. He was the political boss for the first 30 years of the 20th century, and I was writing a novel about him that was very, very bad. It had a lot, I mean, it was just, we won't get into that because it's a whole other thing, but it was a very poor novel, and I was still pouring my heart into it, and through the research, just going through old microfilm of old Omaha World Heralds and Omaha Bees at the library downtown right there on 14th, I came across the headline of a millionaire meat packer son who was kidnapped, and it had the picture of his mansion on the front page. And I made a note of that, and I thought, that's pretty interesting. Like, how often did kidnappings happen back in 1900? It seemed a little odd. But then the more I found out about it, the more I thought, whoa, holy cow. This, forget Tom Dennison, this is the story I need to be telling right here, because, I mean, everything was just kind of ready-made for a novel. I didn't have to invent a lot. I just kind of had to fill in the pieces where you couldn't find anything anymore. So it was serendipitous accident.
And then, Ted, you are writing about one of the worst times in Omaha's history. Why did you pick that event with the lynching of Will Brown? What was it about that?
I think for several reasons that it is such just a big point in the Omaha's history, and I think a turning point where the city up to that point was a much bigger player on the national stage than it has been really since. With the railroad being big at the time and being such a shipping center, I think there were just more artists and entertainers coming out of the city at that time. So in a lot of ways, that kind of drew me to it, along with Tom Dennison, where it was just such a wild and crazy place with a lot of crime in it. But there were a lot of good things that came out of it at the same time, where I guess modernism had kind of arrived in Omaha by that point. So the city had changed a lot. Beyond that, I work as a reporter at the courthouse for the last 10 years now, so it was just the place itself was in my daily routine and in my life, just being there all the time. So it was something I thought a lot about just because of proximity more than anything.
Great. Well, continuing with you and then also with Tim, since we're speaking tonight from the museum and our talk is about objects of inspiration, and we have some objects out here, can you guys speak about a little bit about your process and using the artifacts? What were you hoping to gain when you came to us and said, what do you have on, you know, these topics? What was that experience like? What did it help you do?
Sure. One of the things that, well, the photos that I chose, I think they were running behind me there, but rather than the grand court and the lagoon and all these images that you can see here on display at the museum here, one of the challenges for any novelist is to write beyond your experience, right? To explore those things you don't know. And so in trying to write about the exposition, there was a great deal of material about the exposition itself, but even then, not as much as I would have liked. But not every nook and cranny of it is represented in the historical documents. But I wanted to learn more about the everydayness of it, about the lives, the in and out of it, what they ate, how they dressed. So I was always trying to get a little bit closer to that, which is why I'm glad to see this dress here, this garment, because there was this sense that even with the newspaper articles and all the pictures, I had trouble just stepping into the world. And there was actually an article a couple of weeks ago in the New York Times, the writer Laura Shapiro was writing about, she was lamenting that not enough people documented their dinner failures, that a lot of times if you're Instagramming, you photograph your most photogenic meals, right? Your best best creations. But she wants, she's calling, pleading for people to give more details about their just the regular daily habits and how valuable that can be to historians trying to document this sort of thing. And that's the thing that I was looking for when I have been writing about the past, learning more about you're always looking for diaries or something, you know, some collection of observations just by people going through the day-to-day of their lives, which is why in the Omaha Bee newspaper there was a section called The Domain of Woman. And The Domain of Woman ended up giving a lot of really valuable information about trends and traditions and etiquette and things that I could use to actually inhabit the world of the characters.
Yeah, I think for mine, somewhat similar to that, where at least in my book, like big historical events take up a lot of the story, the ride itself, bigger baseball games. So I kind of had these set pieces that I could write. But the more challenging part is always just writing character and trying to get into their lives, specifically when it was 100 years ago. So I think somewhat, you know, just going through that process and even just seeing what objects people had, what they looked like, the size of things, so you could kind of get a sense how big people were, like how much space they'd take up, was really important. I don't know, I would come here quite a bit during the process and even just kind of hang out around things. I don't know if I was waiting for like divine inspiration or something like that, but it kind of works that way. It's just meditative in a way, if you're there long enough where you connect to an object in a way that you wouldn't if it wasn't right in front of you.
And I will say that in The Domain of Woman in Omaha Bee, there was, I think that's where I saw the mention of the chameleon pin. Chameleons were big in the 1890s in general, but there seems to have been a fad of women wearing chameleons as jewelry, but I haven't been able to find that much information about it. I think on one of the episodes of Antiques Roadshow, they had a pin with a little leash that the antique dealer suspected had once belonged to a chameleon. So I decided I had enough information to include it in the book, the world that I was describing, and that, you know, the doctor and the opium den and all of that, you know, these were things that were suggested in the newspapers and suggested in the historical document, but required some imagination to fill in. And you try to build that imagination from the foundational materials, I guess, from the reality of it as much as you can find.
And Andy, you also use the photo archive predominantly for your research. And I know when we were talking about this presentation, you had said that you'd have them in front of you when you were writing. Just to kind of get the feel, can you talk a little bit about what you gained from the images and kind of how they helped in your writing process?
Sure. I would just stare at a certain photo sometimes for 3 or 4 hours and try to imagine what it was like to live inside that picture, because you only have so much research that you can find. But also here, if you go through like things, the Ernest Buffett, like the little store shop mm-hmm. that you have, and then like the home mm-hmm. and stuff, and then even just if you go up, you know, when you walk upstairs and look out the windows over the train tracks and across the street to the Burlington Depot, to imagine that scene and what it would have felt like to have seen more people waiting for the arrival of this notorious kidnapper than were there to greet President Roosevelt when he came through on his bit of reelection tour for president. It's just, I looked at photos primarily because that's mainly how I process my images as a writer, is visually, almost, you know, like cinematic is how I would go through the process of creating the world on the page. But they're also just kind of, especially a place like this, just to stand in there and kind of imagine like the storefront and then the house and then standing out looking at the tracks too. That was all very helpful.
Fantastic. When you were standing there, did anybody ever come up to you and be like, what are you doing?
I don't remember. They may have. I probably didn't hear.
I am ideating. Leave me alone. So for all three of you guys, I mean, you have a fairly concise time frame. You're in relatively the same time, but three very different events. For all of you, why do you think that these are important events to know and learn about today? What do you want your readers to take away from your books? Opportunity to go deep.
Omaha's a bad, bad place, man, or it used to be. I mean, that's what drew me in first is that, you know, you think for the most part, this is a very nice city. It's always voted in one of the top places in the country to raise a family. But someone who grew up here and finally, like, discovering at the age of 27 or 28 that this used to be a really violent, dangerous town. Like, on the map with Chicago, like, during Prohibition with Al Capone, like, it was, it kind of was exciting to think of coming from a place like that when all I had known growing up was something very placid and safe. And to think that it used to be very different and had changed so much in just a short period of time, I thought, why don't more people know about Omaha history, especially the dark sides of it? And because that's what interested me the most as a writer, is kind of uncovering some of that. And I started with Tom Dennison because that's what I found out first as a writer when I was going back through Omaha's past. And then you find out more and more, and you peel back layers and find out, wow, there was a lot. I mean, just like, for example, Timothy's book takes place in 1898. Mine takes place between 1900 and 1905. And then Ted's takes place just around World War I, leading up to the race riots in 1919. So basically, you have three different novels, mm-hmm. all within basically a 20-year time span in Omaha history, all detailing very different stories. So it was a very dynamic city around the turn of the 20th century, and I think that that should excite people and get them interested to find out more.
So this is a pretty heady question, or just like, what do you want people to get out of the book? I think for me, like around the same time that I was researching and writing the book, I was also doing more family history into my own family. And specifically with the Wheeler branch of it, there isn't a lot known about people. They were more from southern Missouri. What I picked up, the reason was that there were just a lot of bad people, or people did bad things in the family, and people didn't talk about them because it was bad and it was shameful. But at this point, like, they're basically lost to history then, because people didn't want to talk about it. So going off of that kind of feeling, like, I often thought writing the book just that many of the people who did things during the riot, that they would still have family in Omaha, and probably a lot of people who live in Omaha are somewhat connected to it. So it's not necessarily like to call people out, but I think just thinking about legacy of the event, that, you know, it happened 100 years ago, and in what ways is the race riot and the lynching of Will Brown still with us? In what ways, as like the geography of the city still remains somewhat unchanged since then? So, I don't know. There were things that I thought about a lot during when I was writing the book, and I'm not exactly sure how that works out. I've been writing an essay that was supposed to come out the week the book was released, kind of on my process of writing the book, and this is the subject that I'm writing the essay on, which I'm not quite done with it, and the book came out almost 2 months ago. So it is, you know, a difficult subject to think through. But that was a lot of the rumination that I was thinking about on why I guess it's important to still think about the riot, even though, you know, it's not like a Chamber of Commerce kind of subject, I guess.
That might be more of Tim's book, The Chamber of Commerce. All right, well, that will conclude our lecture presentation for this evening. Thank you all so much for a wonderful presentation.
You've been listening to a lecture program from the Durham Museum on Noon Forum. We've heard a presentation by three Omaha authors, each of whose novels take place in Omaha within a 20-year period of the early 20th century, the 1898 Trans-Mississippi and International Exposition, Omaha from 1900 to 1905, and the 1919 race riots. Timothy Shaffert, author of The Swan Gondola, Andrew Hilleman, author of World Chase Me Down, and Theodore Wheeler, author of Kings of Broken Things. The title of their presentation was Objects of Inspiration, Creating Historical Fiction Based in Fact. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, September 26, 2017, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Jessica Brummer, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 700 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Coate, thanking you for listening.